music. Okay.
California.
That I'm changing that opening theme. This is, it's got me every day this week. This is Mike Vandervoort. It's Friday, August 21st, and it's the last day of what's been a pretty long, busy week for me, and I'm sure a lot of others. Really excited to have a new guest on the show, and that is Sue Messenger, who is from, has ran Shorm for a long time. Sue, welcome to Drive Through HR, and thanks for being our guest.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, I thought it would be, you know, we, you and I have been connected through social media for a long time, and I actually met you at the Shorm booth in some year when, you know, where the, but we shook hands, but you and I have not had a chance to really talk a lot in person, so this is interesting for me, and, you know, and, but anyway, I guess, Sue, what, you know, give us your bio, give us your background, so before we start, we'll get into the questions.
By training, I'm a lawyer. Although I generally didn't talk about that with HR professionals because I've learned that they're not fans of lawyers since they have to deal with them so often. And, you know, I was with Shorm for 21 years. Prior to coming to Shorm, I was Deputy Undersecretary of Labor, and I ran the agency at the Department of Labor that included wage and hour and OFCCP and the Federal Workers' Comp Program. And it was a great job for somebody who was really young at the time. In retrospect, I see that, with 4,000 employees and a few billion dollars in federal budget responsibility. And prior to that, I was did regulatory affairs with a trade association in Washington. When I joined Shorm, I was brought on. It was then ASPA, which for those people who are listening who are have long tenures will remember. The American Society for Personnel Administration, and I did government affairs. And the government affairs shop at the time was myself and one other professional staff person and an admin. And I think we had 46,000 members in the organization. The staff was maybe 30 or 40 people. And as the organization grew, so too did the government affairs activities and my responsibilities. So that ultimately I was chief operating officer and then was made CEO. And I was CEO for about 8 years before retiring, 6 years before retiring.
And you retired like four or five years ago? Was it? Has it been that long?
Oh, it's been longer. It's been since 2008.
Hank, yeah, because we had Hank, and there was Lon for a little while, and that, and then okay, and China was interim, and so on. So I guess you know we were talking on the pre-show about the theme of drive-through HR, and I liked your reaction about why did they pick me to talk about that, and we pick everybody to talk about it, but we're trying to explore the theme with HR professionals about making mistakes, you know, and we call it failure to give it a little sensationalism, and then how do you grow from that? How did you pivot? And so like, I guess you know you have such a broad background. I mean, I know you had some, you know, in your regulatory agency years, you had exposure, you know, and at the DOL and with the government and then with Shorm. So you've got these broad experiences in different organizations. And of course, the government stuff was a while ago, and there's like a whole new, you know, generation of that going on right now. That's, well, maybe we'll get into NLRB towards the end. But when you join Shorm, you know, because like Mike Aiken, I'm on one of the panels now, and I'm Mike Aiken and his crew.
Who's wonderful, by the way.
I love Mike, and you know, this isn't. Yeah, it's not a lot. Mike is super busy, but yeah, he's really knowledgeable and he's really good. In fact, he's speaking for me at the Q conference that we have going on in Denver. He's going to give an update on, you know, global U.S. and global labor, you know, HR policy, but he's going to focus a bit on what's going on with DOL, what's going on with LRB, and he just had the opportunity to be an ILO delegate for the U.S., so he's going to speak to us a little bit about his experience in Europe with the ILO, which I think will be really interesting for Q members that have a global bent, so I'm very excited to have him. Why don't we go backwards a little bit and maybe go back to when you first joined joined SHRM because it was a, I mean, I was an ASPA member as a student, and then for a while in the Michigan state of Michigan, I was an ASPA member before it switched over to SHRM.
Uh-huh.
That seemed so long ago. But what was it? You know, what was it like when it was still ASPA? I mean, there were some big changes that have happened in the last, you know, some under your watch, and certainly they've evolved mm-hmm. since then. But what were your challenges back then? Because it was a smaller organization, and we're a lot different now. So,
Well, what I discovered when I got there was that, you know, my focus was on public policy and, you know, what how to advance the voice of the profession in the public policy arena. And the first thing I discovered was that the positions that were being taken by the organization on legislation were determined by a committee of volunteers, a bunch of white guys, frequently sitting at a bar, and most typically following whatever the white papers were that came from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And so, and while, you know, HR are managers, they are on the management side, and so they tend to have a management perspective on issues that come up in the public policy arena, I also knew that they had a different perspective on many management issues in terms of, you know, what the impact would be. They had real hands-on, practical understanding of implications that really, in a, you know, when you're lobbying, some of the general business tenor was more general. It wasn't very specific. And so the first thing I did is started working with all the committees that were in place, the volunteers, to sort of run draft positions through the volunteers and then through the board to just make sure that we had greater input into what the public positioning was. Because as I said then and I have said ever since, for somebody who's working on behalf of a profession in Washington, if you're going to go running up a mountain to fight a battle, you don't want to turn around and see that there's nobody behind you. You want to make sure that what you're doing is representing the interest. Now, you know, with any membership organization, obviously, you never get everybody because there's a difference of perspective. That, you know, HR professionals aren't the Stepford HR profession. But to just get a broad general sense of what the view would be to make sure that's what you're reflecting. So I think that was the big change. And frankly, it's one of the things that I was proud about, that we were, in doing that, we also tapped into HR professionals who had great expertise on different topics. Because, you know, there's no way that the staff in Washington can have the front line understanding and experience of some of these issues that they're confronted with through legislation. And so we were able to build on, you know, like folks like you, you're on one of those committees now who can be called on to help ensure that whatever the public policy is, I mean, we may not win, we may disagree, but if I had a sense that the public policymakers had a greater understanding of the underlying issues, I felt like we were making a good contribution to the cause.
Yeah, and just comment on that for a second. I know there are a lot of other folks who are on a lot of other HR pros who are on different panels with SHRM at all levels. But it's been, I served on that special expertise panel for labor relations, and I think this is my third or fourth year. And it's been, you know, there's 15 people or so, and we work pretty closely with Mike Aiken, as I was saying to you earlier. And it really is a conduit to not only to get a really great insight into what's going on in D.C., you know, as an individual who isn't there a lot. So it's incredibly invaluable to me in that way to have those contacts, because I have other folks, but those are my best ones right there. But the other side of it is you know, we'll talk about seat at the table and all that kind of crazy stuff that HR people always have angst about in a minute, but I know we won't really talk about it. I don't. But the point I was going to make is you know, by being on those panels, I have found that I was able to bring forward from my industry perspective or from the things that I focus on as an HR person, bring them forward not only to SHRM, but to also bring them forward to other HR professionals that serve on the committee, because we're not all aware of everything that's going on. And so, you know, there was a time a couple years ago when this whole alt-labor movement, the sort of the new labor movement mm-hmm. for the Fight for 15 and all of that was first advancing, and there were a lot of players from big manufacturers or from healthcare where they weren't really affected by that, and they didn't have their eye on that as a trend. But myself and another Eric Oppenheimer, another member of that committee, flagged it and raised it up, and actually you know, wound up getting SHRM to not only pay attention, but in some cases take positions on an issue. So it's, I mean, you're right. I mean, I guess the power of that in the organization is a lot different than just going to a SHRM conference or, you know, attending for learning. You can really make a difference. And so what I'm touting, I guess, is if people are interested in those things, they should apply and they should definitely take part. It's been an incredible experience for me.
Absolutely. And I'd also say, that by paying attention to that, knowing what the issues are that are appearing on the regulatory agenda, and submitting comments on the regulatory side of things, it can really make a difference. I was at the Department of Labor for 6 years. We did a lot of rulemaking, notice and rulemaking, and we had to address and look at and review all the comments that we got. And comments that come in from the public, especially those that aren't form letters, that sort of articulate, this is what you're proposing, this is how this will impact my workplace and my employees, the people that work here, and this is, you know, what is a particularly compelling for both Congress and the regulatory bodies, is when you can articulate what is the impact going to be on job growth. You can really make a difference. And people think the government's too big, it's too, you know, just me against them, I'll never make a difference. And, I know from personal experience being on the inside at the Department of Labor that those comments make a difference. And it's unfortunate sometimes people don't realize that and take advantage and sort of let people know what they think, even if they disagree. Again, if you help policymakers have a broader understanding of the issue, the outcome is likely to be better for everybody.
And the truth is, they're required to read, you know, maybe not to read every word, but they're required to read and review all the comments as part of the decision.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not like
there are lots of court decisions. There are lots of court decisions where they have to do an analysis and evaluate and sort of respond to everything that's been brought forward.
So to your point, it can make a difference. The unfortunate side of that is that it's become a kind of a process that outside organizations are wielding. You know, people pile up with comments now on both sides of a controversial issue, just like they. So it actually makes the process more difficult. But I suppose in the long run, that dialogue and having the government have to listen to it and it be presented and then respond and react to it, I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily, but it's different. So going back, I'm probably going to jump around all over this conversation.
That's okay.
So going back to ASPA, was it under your direction that ASPA transformed the organization into SHRM, or was that under another director?
Well, I was there when it happened. The CEO was, it was 1990, I think, so it would have been Mike Losey, either the end
Mike
of Ron
Losey.
Polenza, who's the present CEO, or Mike Losey, who started in 1990 with the organization. And that was a significant financial investment where we work with a branding firm to go through the process of sort of looking at names, what names were already taken, taking this name, the society's name, and the logo. And under, while I was the CEO, we changed the logo from the HR in the box to the SHRM logo. And I have to say, this is sort of, you know, one of my learnings. When I sat down with the staff, and again, we were investing lots of money with a branding firm, and the staff said, we think we need to change the logo. You know, as the CEO, what I heard was, ka-ching, 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 you know, and it was like, oh my God, you know, in terms of budget implications for, changing all signage, everything. And I said, you're going to really have to convince me on that one. And, you know, what they did is they said, they helped me sort of focus on the fact you've got this brand that has an HR in the box and the name under it, but everybody knows you as Sherm. And we had had in place for, 10 years, the rule that don't refer to us as Sherm. It's Society for Human Resource Management.
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of they slapped me on the face with was, you know, if your customer is calling you Sherm, you're Sherm. You know, you're right. And it was one of those where, okay, I was wrong to resist. Let's go with it. Let's do it. And led to this logo that we have now.
So logos are, in branding, that's like, today in today's world, that's an ongoing thing all the time. You know, I talked to someone yesterday and she made the statement, something like, I am a brand. And then she went, "Pah! I can't believe that just came flying out of my face," which made me laugh, but it's true. I mean, there, every person has, kind of has an employment, I mean, if you have a profile, you sort of have a brand. SHRM, Sherm, or as some people call it, drives me crazy, Shroom. I hate that one. Sherm has a...
Shrum.
Shrum, yeah, that one too.
Yeah.
But so you made a... Anyway, so their brand is...
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, to me, brand is a fancy word for reputation.
Yeah.
That personal brand, I think that's just new speak for I have a reputation. This is what I'm seen as. This is what I'm known for. This is how people perceive me.
And I've been in the profession for, slightly under 30 years. And I was a student member of ASPA, as I said, and I was a member of local chapters of, ASPA and then later Sherm in Michigan. But I was not an active participant. I didn't go to monthly meetings. Mm-hmm. I didn't volunteer. I'd go a couple times a year. I'd get the newsletters mailed to me in HR magazine because it was a good resource. And every now and then I was probably a typical consumer of Sherm of that time, which was not a giant investment in time, and really, I only became active personally when China Gorman entered Twitter, and I was kind of we were nagging her about all these things, and she challenged
stuff,
me. Right. Yeah, the social media stuff. We were nagged because we had access to somebody there, and we were talking to her, and she, her challenge back was, "Well, what are you doing? It sounds like you have a lot of ideas. What are you doing with them?" And, that got me involved at a much different level with Sherm, and a non-traditional path, by the way. I didn't come up through the organization, and serve as an officer and all that stuff. I got involved with HR Florida at the state level and then now with Sherm at the national level. But it's been
That's pretty typical. That's the very typical way. Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen some of the people I knew, kind of went through the local chapter, and then they went into the state chapter, and then I just got involved because of social media and a challenge from China, and it in the last last 10 years, it's made a huge difference for me professionally, which I found very interesting. But you made a comment way back at the beginning when we started talking here. You said you found that a lot of stuff was white guys in a room, and it Sherm has changed a lot. And that now we have this, joke, kind of running joke about HR ladies, that there's so many more women in the profession, and that many of the Sherm conferences are, 80% female. I don't know if those numbers are real, but that's what it feels like to me sometimes as a guy. Definitely much more diverse. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was thinking about is that ASPA, Sherm, then the moving into the net, moving Ron Polenzo, who just passed away, moved the organization, I guess, from Ohio to Washington, D.C. So Sherm has done a lot over the years to try to, to remain relevant or become more relevant. But they've also had a few, a few glitches like any organization does. So I guess what do you think were the biggest challenges you faced during your time as CEO? What did you face, and how did you kind of respond to that beyond the branding stuff?
Well, I think one of the challenges and is the what's wrong with HR drumbeat, which actually it's been there for 30 years.
Are we worse or better than lawyers at that?
I think every profession is sort of navel-gazing in terms of what should they be doing, what they're not doing right. The difference with HR, I think, is HR, by its very nature, is personal.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the accountants who they can, you know, when they make an error in their numbers, they just reverse out the error and fix it. And HR, if it makes a mistake, you know, somebody's life is impacted.
Right.
When people have personal dealings with HR, it's about something that's about them. It's about their job title, their compensation level, their promotional opportunities, their professional development opportunities, their manager, how their manager is treating them. It's very personal, and there is no way that you're going to have people feeling that HR has taken care of what it is that they brought, because there's no way HR can do that. And I sometimes think that HR as a profession needs group therapy to just sort of, you know, ignore this, you know, this kind of talk about HR, you know, everything that's wrong with HR, and focus on continuous improvement, what's out there that can make you more effective, make a better place to work that's more profitable, that's more successful if you're not profit, and don't let yourself get sucked into the woe is me and victim mentality. You know, you talked early about the seat at the table rhetoric. And one of the things that I asked the staff to do with the publications was to never have articles that were that sort of titled, "How Can You Get a Seat at the Table?" Or which is because I would rather have the title being, "While you're at the table, this is what you should be doing."
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have the title or you have all these headlines out there saying, "What's wrong with HR?" or, you know, "How HR needs to be better," what you're saying is that all of us aren't doing everything that we could do. Now, if you change the terminology and say, "While you're at the table, this is what should be happening," there's the presumption, the baseline presumption is that you're competent and you're there and you're participating. How do you be better at it? It's a slight difference in wording, but I think it really is a big change. It's a difference of viewing, "I'm one of many, we all have this problem," versus, "What do I need to be doing to be more effective where I am? You know, this profession
yeah.
is good. How do I get better?"
I definitely agree with that statement, and I definitely agree that we are, you know, almost interminably navel gazers. It kind of drives me crazy. In fact, there's a new group that a few people just formed, about 350 members, HR Positive, right? I'm like, that's cool.
Yes,
but,
yes, LinkedIn group, right.
Yeah, LinkedIn group. And, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, it's, you know, down with the HR, hate HR stories. And, you know, this I think
right.
the same thing. We've seen recently, I was talking about this with someone earlier in the week, we've seen, you know, the Amazon article in the New York Times, and I don't want to go into that
mm-hmm.
specifically, but there's kind of we have this, you know, short attention span theater mentality, and then everybody loves to jump on a, you know, so whether it's Holacracy at Zappos or, you know, Amazon makes their
right.
people work hard or whatever it is, there seems to be this much greater, deeper interest in takedown stories than there are in the really cool things that people do, and I don't understand that, I guess, and that I think if HR Positive can change that a little bit, that would be good.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely wish I feel like the table argument is somewhat, we're somewhat over it as a profession, but now it's, should we change from the name from HR to something else? And I have no idea what that would be. HR.
When Sherm went through the name change from personnel administration, it really was sort of a theological debate between
mm-hmm.
folks who felt it should be personnel, because these were people after all, they weren't resources, human resources. It really was a theological. And for me, when people would ask me, you know, "What do you think the new title should be?" And it's like, you know what, I really don't think you need to spend a lot of time worrying about that. It's what should the people be doing in the jobs, and not sort of spend your time within your organization trying to lobby for a new job title. It's like, you know, prove your mettle and you'll get the respect that you deserve. It's not going to be the name.
Yeah, and the whole debate of certification and the whole thing with HRCI and SHRM last year. I mean, there's all these sort of things. And I mean, SHRM admitted they slipped up a little bit and jumped the gun. And it seems to be what it means to me on a twice a year basis is I get to apply for two different kinds of credits now. They actually made more work for me as somebody who runs conferences. Thanks a lot. But it did improve the process. But I guess the SHRM has definitely, with the certification, with the move to DC, with the global emphasis on responding to the globe. I mean, they take their share of criticism, but a lot of times in the long run, these moves have apparently turned out to be right. As somebody who ran the organization for a while, how did, because we're down to about 5 minutes, this is going by really fast.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked a little bit about how you listen to your staff and you listen to other people. How did you develop the foresight, to have those type of plans in place? And how do you guide an organization like that, which is largely a volunteer run organization?
Well, my mantra was, and it still is, if you take care of the members will take care of you. And it really was, when faced with a decision of paths, which path to take, it was sort of like, well, which is going to be best to serve the profession, serve the professional and advance the profession. And it's really not complicated. When you sort of keep pulling things back, what makes the most sense, what's going to be best for the member, it really provides a great North Star. I think for the CEO, one of the challenges that I had was SHRM has got a great staff. I had wonderful staff, the organization, and I'm sure they're just as good now. And they're creative, they're smart, great ideas. And I think one of the toughest jobs for a CEO is saying, that's a great idea. No.
Hmm.
Because you lose focus. And I think if I look back where I think I may have failed, I still think as many times as I said no, I probably should have said no more often to sort of keep it tight and focused, because you can't be all things to all people.
Thanks. Great advice. I think, kind of timeless advice, but that is, somebody does have to eventually say no. And so I want to kind of end on this note. You mentioned DOL, your old experience. What's your mm-hmm. perspective of today's DOL? I'm not asking you to knock, but the NLRB, the Department of Labor, there's definitely been a correction from the Bush years, to something new in the Obama years. What's your take on that, and where do you think we're headed in the next, while?
I think what you're going to see is the whole notion of income inequality, and I think what you're seeing in the electorate, in terms of candidates like Trump and Bernie Sanders, who don't come out of sort of the traditional political machines, I think it's a reflection of the growing sort of concern over income inequality and sort of the haves and have-nots. And I think it's much more visible because of things like social media, that people are more aware of some of these things. And I think it's a dramatic, we're seeing a shift. The question is, how far will the shift go? And is the shift so far that it really has a negative impact on economic development and opportunity because of all of the layers of bureaucracy that get laid on businesses, as people try and control and change that? I think there's a risk for over-regulation and compensation, and the cure may be worse than the illness at the rate some of these things are going.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
I was going to say, even just yesterday or the day before, Walmart announced its earnings, short-term stuff, right? And because they gave a lot of wage increases in response to mm-hmm. market, it hurt their stock, and the stock market took a bit of a tumble. Not just on that, but certainly
right.
a lot more drivers than that. But while it sounds great to lift the boats and pay everybody more, there are some back end impacts, and that's my area of focus is labor mm-hmm. relations. But I don't find that HR people pay enough attention to it, and there's a lot of that going on, and it's going to be with us for a few more years. So I think it's important that you call
I think
that.
You're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. I think the reality is organized labor, the penetration now is so below 10% in the private sector. So most HR professionals think NLRB, NLRA stuff is not my problem, and they don't understand what the notion is of what's concerted activity, basics of, two people coming together is concerted activity, and they just are not paying attention. But they'll find out, won't they, Michael?
They will find out sooner or later. Yeah, there's NLRB is imposing more difficult or more harsh remedies and all kinds of things. So, yeah, a lot
right.
more labor charges and, so on. Anyway, that's another show for another topic or another topic for another
okay.
show. We are 31 minutes in. I told you I'd hold it to about a half an hour. So you're out on the Cape, which is a lovely place to be in the summer. I'm jealous of you. What have you got going on? What have you got going on besides hanging out at the beach? Anything you'd like to mention in parting, or are you happily retired at this point?
No, I still dabble. I continue to do my column on HR Executive on HR Leadership, my monthly column, and do some consulting, do some speaking. And I'm on the board for the National Academy of Human Resources, advisory board for Cronus Workforce Institute. So I'm keeping busy. I'm where I think most people want to be. I'm doing whatever I damn well please.
Nice, nice. Well, I'm jealous about that now, too, so I have yet another reason to be jealous of Sue Messenger. Listen, thanks so much for being a guest on the show today. I'm going to play a little music, hopefully, that will take us out. And if you want to listen to yourself, the link to the show should be up on Blog Talk soon. Thanks so much for this, Sue. I really
okay.
appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for inviting.
Bye.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.